Hi there, this is Tracy Rogers, and you're listening to Faith and the Revolution. Hey there, welcome to Faith and the Revolution. My name's Tracy, and I'll be your host. In this episode, I don't even know where to begin with this episode. This was a conversation that had been inspired a number of different times. And when the Breonna Taylor verdict came out last year, it was a conversation that then needed to be had. And I recorded this last October in 2020 with my friend Whitney. And, you know, Whitney and I, we've been friends for a few years, and we would regularly meet up in DC when it was still safe at Calabash Tea and Tonic in the Shaw Howard neighborhood. And we would just talk real talk about anything and everything. And the fact that she allowed me to record one of our conversations is a real honor and privilege, not just to me, but to anyone who's listening. I feel like it's a privilege and honor to just hear Black women speak, period. And so this is really a gift in so many ways. And in this conversation, we talk about the experience of being a Black woman in America, which is not at all a new conversation. And I thought it would be fitting and appropriate to share this conversation as we mourn the death of Breonna Taylor at the hands of police a year later, and of course, celebrating Women's History Month. When I reflect on this conversation, it makes me think of this quote, and I don't know where I heard it from. It's not mine. If anyone else has heard it, please let me know and credit, who said it. I feel like Ashley C. Ford said it. I don't know. But it's this quote that Black women are the conscience of white supremacy. And it's so powerful and it's so true. And I feel like in many ways that quote is at the root of this conversation. My friend Whitney is a writer from Fort Worth, Texas, who believes in magic. She is a beautiful Black alchemist who occasionally creates sweet-smelling healing body products. And she also occasionally produces a beautiful meditative newsletter called Juju. She's also just hella wise and graceful and so honest in such a raw way in this conversation. I won't use the word radical because I feel like that word is poorly defined in today's society. In a raw, wise, honest, graceful way, she shares her thoughts and beliefs and expresses her voice and opinions. And this whole episode really is just in honor of Black women everywhere. Take a listen, y'all. All right. So we are live. Woo! So thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me. I've been wanting to talk to you about this very topic for a while now. This topic on the experience of Black women in a society that, you know, centers and is built on whiteness. Mm. And you know, you and I, we talk regularly and we always have these really important conversations. And I remember there was one conversation we were having. We were sitting at Calabash Tea in DC talking about the experience of Black women, especially in the workforce. And as we continued just dialoguing in months that followed, especially, you know, after we found out about Breonna Taylor and, you know, just the injustices that Black women tend to experience at disproportionate rates, right? I remember a comment you made in just saying, like, this country doesn't deserve Black women. And
yeah, that was after we had found out about the VP pick. Yeah,
that's right. Yes. And when you said it, I was just like, you're so right. And we need to talk about that more, you know, just the frustration that comes with being a Black woman in this country, feeling, you know, unheard, unseen. I always go back to that quote with Malcolm X about, you know, how the most disrespected, unprotected, mm-hmm. neglected person in America is the Black woman. Mm-hmm. I also always think about that interview that Cecily Tyson did with, I think it was Gail. And she was saying how, like, on the ladder to success, you have the white man at the top of the rung or at the top of the ladder, and then underneath him is the Black man, underneath him is the white woman, and then hanging at the bottom, holding on for dear life, is the Black woman. So white man, white woman, Black woman. And not only are we hanging on at the bottom, but people are climbing on top of us to get up there. So mm-hmm. we're also kind of like the ledge or the segue or bridge mm-hmm. that gets people up there. Mm-hmm. So all of that just kind of came to me in that one statement. And that's why I've been wanting to talk to you. And then, of course, with the latest verdict on Breonna Taylor, I'm like, yeah, it's time to have this conversation. So, yeah.
And thank you for inviting me, and thank you for creating a space for this, because, I mean, you know me, like, I'm a pretty introverted person. I don't, I don't engage in conversations like this with too many people. And I, you know, honestly, I've probably just always felt like my views were like just a little bit too radical, like a little bit out of mainstream. But I'm really happy that if anything has come of this, you know, very chaotic season, it's that people are really starting to see America for what it is. Mm. People are starting to see Black women for who we are. Most importantly, Black women are starting to see ourselves.
Yes.
For who we are. And I think a lot of, you know, anything you just named, whether it's Black women in the workplace, whether it's Black women, you know, having conversations with police or the criminal justice system, so much of how Black women relate to other people, Black men, white women, white men. I fully understand that there are more than just Black and white people in this country, but, you know, I think for the purpose of this conversation, at least for me, it helps to kind of narrow it down to those two groups. Mm-hmm. But, like, so much of how we relate comes from how we functioned during enslavement, mm-hmm. and who we were, yep. to the planter capitalist machine. Mm. You know, we were baby makers, we were breeders, we were people who could work in the field and in the house. Mm-hmm. We were people who could be as strong, as physically strong as a Black man, but also have this superpower of being able to nurse other people's children. And, you know, and there's a quote in Zora Neale Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, and the protagonist, Janie, is remembering a quote that her grandmother told her. And it's, you know, basically, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but she's like, you know, as far as I can see, Black women are the mules of the world. Mm. And for those of us who, you know, our grandparents grew up on farms, or we know something about farms, mules are work animals. They are not beautiful. They're not treated as well as horses. They do things that people don't want to do to their horse, because horses are more expensive. They don't provide food like pigs and chickens and cows. You know, they have this very specific function on a farm. And I think a lot of that has historically applied to how other people see Black women. Mm-hmm. Now, I think how we see ourselves is totally different. I think we've always seen ourselves as beautiful and magical and special. And I think that's part of the reason why our bonds with each other are so much closer than you know, any other group that I can think of or that I've heard about or that I've, you know, read stories about or whatever. It's because we do, like Cicely Tyson said, like you said, like, you know, all these people have said over the years, we have such a unique perspective.
Yeah.
There's no group in the history of the world that has what we have in our lineage and that has had to persevere what we have persevered, not even Black men.
Right.
And to me, that's the controversial part, because I know a lot of us were raised to see Black women and Black men as family, as having the same struggle, or seeing Black men as having more of a struggle than Black women. So I think when you really start to put the Black woman at the center of, like, you know, American life, American identity, American struggle, America's hypocrisies, I think that in and of itself is pretty radical, because people really willfully don't see us and don't see everything that we are and everything that we go through.
Right. Well, and I appreciate you bringing it back to, you know, the purpose of Black women during slavery and how that has been carried over to modern day 2020. Mm-hmm. And even what happened after slavery when Jim Crow took over and a lot of our Black men were imprisoned and there was convict leasing and all of these things that made it so the white or the Black woman was literally doing everything, mm-hmm. Doing the work, caring for the family, keeping the family unit together. So we just kind of, our duties, not just with physical laboring, but emotional laboring, just amplified during this time even more so. And so I really appreciate you capturing that in history. And I also appreciate you, you know, mentioning that our experience is like no other experience. And it's funny because I was just having this conversation with another friend and we were talking about, you know, how white feminism is just so uninspiring. You know, like there's nothing motivating about it. There's nothing that I, as a Black woman, aspire to. And it's funny because the reason why this conversation even happened is because I was talking about how I found it interesting, and this is probably going to be something controversial that I say, but how I found it interesting that, you know, when we talk about self-motivational work and healing and things of that nature, that you're seeing ancestral healing being introduced or ancestral work being introduced in white circles that do this. And all I can think to myself is what does that look like? When I think of your ancestors, when I think of my ancestors, you know, what's this?
Hello. About?
Exactly. Is this cultural appropriation again? What's this? Hello. About, you know? And so that's what led this conversation. And
sorry, not to cut you off, but that should be framed as ancestral forgiveness.
Yes. Exactly.
Like, even the framing is off on that.
Right. Exactly. And so what you just said, as far as the Black woman's experience being one like no other, just again, it really reaffirms and reinforces that our magic is real, you know, when it comes to our lineage and where we come from and the gifts that we brought to from the old world, you know, it really again further kind of solidifies the power that we inherently possess. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that. And it's funny because, you know, you and I had reached out to you a while ago about, you know, talking about this. And then, you know, as I always do, I like disappeared. Breonna verdict, Breonna Taylor verdict came out. And I said, you know what? It's time for me and Whitney to talk. Yeah. And in the midst of that, just, I mean, yeah, all the things as far as feelings and sentiments around that, I came across this quote by Dr. Nikki Washington. And she wrote, "This country will murder a black woman in March, deny her justice in September, and then expect black women to save everyone in November." And when I read that, it just hit me in my core, because it is the classic story of black women to the rescue. I mean, when we talk about, you know, politics, for example, mm-hmm. who's voting for the Democrats? Mm-hmm. Black women, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about community organizing, who's at the head of it all? It's black mm-hmm. women.
Yeah.
And so it really just hit me. And, you know, there's on the one hand this feeling of pride, because I come from a lineage of black women who can in fact move mountains. Like, there's that pride in knowing that, yeah, we can do all of the things because we have that kind of strength. Mm. And then coupled with that feeling is this, why is it expected that we do all of the things, right? Mm-hmm. And then coupled with that feeling is frustration that, you know, unfortunately it's been passed down to us that we have to do all of the things, right? At the expense of our health and our wellness. And so that quote really just sums up everything.
Yeah. I mean, you said a lot, and I want to just be clear that, like, I have not been following the news of Breonna Taylor. I have not been following any of the police shootings this year. In previous years, I've been engaged in the fight against police brutality in various ways. But this year, I didn't have anything to give. And so I just want to say, like, I have a general idea of what's happening, but, like, in terms of, like, specifics with the verdict or that case, like, I'm listening to you, and I'm like, I know what happened, because it's the same thing that happens all the time, but, I haven't specifically read up on her. But I think, two things come to mind, based on what you said. And one is that, and this is not my opinion, this is a fact. Black women are both the most civically engaged demographic in the country. So if there are five people walking down the street, and one is an Asian man, and one is a black man, and one is a white man, and one is a Latinx woman, and one is a black woman, I don't know if that's more than five people, but whatever. If there are five people with different identities walking down the street, the person who is most likely to vote is a black woman. We vote at much higher levels than black men, than white men, than white women even. And we know this, that women tend to be more civically engaged than men, but black women even more so. It is also true that black women have been the most consistently progressive demographic in America for at least our lifetime, probably prior to that. Even in the midst of church shootings and vigilantes driving cars into protesters, black people and black women specifically are by and large opposed to the death penalty. Mm-hmm. We are, despite the smear campaign that was happening before, I think it was Prop 8 in California, black people are not any more opposed to marriage equality than any other group. So that in and of itself is remarkable. That tells me that we are a group of people who are incredibly empathetic and who are incredibly willing to do the work, even at our own peril. Mm-hmm. And where I am as an, you know, almost 35-year-old black woman, I was raised to be very civically engaged. I was raised going to the polls, registering people to vote. My grandparents were very involved in voting access and voting rights in my hometown. Keep in mind, neither of them were enfranchised until their 30s. So, you know, voting for them was very different than voting for me. And I was always raised to vote the straight ticket. You know, that I was, you know, I always do my research, you know, and especially living in Texas, well, it's a little bit different because sometimes you will have relatively progressive people who are running Republican because that's just the only way they're going to win. But, you know, in D.C. And then I've lived in PG County and stuff too. And, you know, I still want to like do my research and see. And a lot of times it's Democrats running against Democrats here, right? You know, and I would say ever since like 2012, when, you know, those horrific midterms happened, I've been very disillusioned with the voting process. And 2016 didn't help. Like, I think
not help. Nope.
I think everyone was kind of scratching their heads. Like, how is this the second time a president has assumed office without winning the popular vote in our lifetime? Right. Like, it's becoming a thing.
It's a thing. Right.
And, but like just seeing, you know, especially in local politics here in DC and Maryland, seeing how Black women can't even get on the ticket. Mm-hmm. I was just how?
Right.
How? Like, you know, like the Democratic Party is Black women, period.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
If we all decided not to vote, there would be no DNC.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Because they always want to use these coded words, people of color, disenfranchised. No.
It's Black women. Black women. It's Black women.
Let all the people of color vote for y'all then.
Right.
Exactly. And leave us out of it. Because, you know, I'm really, really torn. And I was really, really torn in 2016 too. And I still voted for Hillary. Mm-hmm. And Tim Kaine, weirdest.
Right.
But again, you know, I didn't go to the Women's March for precisely that reason. I was like, it was not my, I did the right thing.
Right.
For people other than myself.
Right.
I was not voting my own interest. Right. I was voting for who I felt like would have the greatest positive impact. Right,
exactly.
You need to tell me that Black men and white women and Latinx men and Latinx women couldn't do the same thing?
Right, right.
And then you want me to march in January?
Yeah.
No, I took myself to New Orleans and ate beignets and like literally me and my friend Nicole, who you know, and our other friend Diane, we were like, we don't want to be in DC this weekend. No. Because the inauguration, it was the march, and we're like, none of these people we like. Right. So we like went to New Orleans, which is one of our favorite cities, and just, you know, we were Black women being happy. Mm. And that was really a turning point for me, because I was like, you know, I was not put on this earth to be a mule. I was not put on this earth to save anybody. I was not put on this earth to be a part of a voting bloc. Mm. And get nothing back in return. Mm. I mean, Democrats don't have to promise Black women anything. Mm-hmm. We are not a concern for them.
Right, we're not.
And why are we still voting? Like, you know what I mean? Why are we still marching? Why are we still? And so I know that can sound really selfish. And
I don't think that sounds selfish at all. I think that's a shared sentiment. Definitely a shared sentiment with me. I also feel very, you know, disillusioned with the voting process. Yeah. And I was also, you know, same thing. I didn't go to the Women's March either. And I think there were a lot of Black women actually who didn't go to the Women's March because we're always the ones marching anyway. We don't just march when we don't like a president that's been elected. We march for all other things too. And we have been since forever. And so I think there were a lot of Black women, at least, you know, in different circles that I belong to, who were like, you know what? I'm just going to take a break. Let everybody else out there go and march. You know, I'm resting because I do this shit all the time anyway. I am the most civically, you know, engaged person out there, you know, speaking of for Black women. And this is bullshit, you know, this is some BS. So I think a lot of what you're saying are definitely shared sentiments, at least for me, and I'm sure for a Black woman listening. And it also makes me think of the race, this election with Joe Biden. Similar situation where it's like, this is who I have to vote for, you know?
Right.
And I think what frustrated me about that, and this goes to show you again, that the Democratic Party doesn't care about Black women. I would argue don't necessarily care about Black people in general, is because they looked at voting in South Carolina and just assume that Black people everywhere then are going to be about Joe Biden because Black people came out for him in South Carolina. Because again, we are not distinctive in our beliefs and, you know, the ways, our values and what's important to us. If Black people are going to vote for him in South Carolina, it must mean Black people all over the country are going to vote for him. So that was also very infuriating because now, you know, it's another situation where we're stuck with, you know, granted, I want to say the lesser of two evils, although there's a wide gap because Trump is just, you know, but if I had my pick, it certainly would not be Joe Biden 100%. So,
me and one of my best friends actually were talking about exactly that, because I had a conversation with a friend who is a Black male. And I love and respect him, but we had a very different opinion about Trump's response to the pandemic and whether or not, you know, Black people should be voting for Biden. And he had said something, he was joking, but he had said like he was gonna write in Bernie Sanders' names. I'm like, because Bernie Sanders is better than Joe Biden? Like, I'm really confused. First of all, like, what you were saying reminded me, I feel like there is such a gap in logic between people who say, well, both candidates are bad, so I'm not going to vote. That's illogical for so many reasons. If you really have issues with the two-party system, which most people do, if you really say, well, all politicians lie, which, yeah, that's been the case since the first politician, so I don't know why all of a sudden that's like a thing now, or if you really, you know, have a studied argument as to why, you know, your efforts are not best utilized voting, that's a whole different thing. But I'm talking about people who maybe have voted in the past, maybe voted in the primaries for, you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders, or, you know, gave money to Bernie or whatever. It's people who were civically engaged to some extent and then say because their candidate did not win the primary that they are not going to vote, or that they're going to vote for the opposite party. Mm-hmm. And we saw a lot. Well, according to the news, who knows? People lie so much about who they vote for. But, you know, there was a lot of news coverage about Bernie supporters who voted for Trump in 2016, which I don't think you're a Bernie supporter, but if you are, I apologize and you were excluded from this statement. But his supporters are so freaking weird to me because they are so extremist, and not even in like, again, a studied radical way.
Right.
It literally just seemed like they want a rabble rouser. They want to blow up
right
the system. And I'm all for blowing up the system and creating something else.
Exactly.
Blowing up the system because
you gotta replace it with something. Right.
So I find that like huge gap in logic, and I've seen it on social media much more with Black men than Black women, but I have seen a few Black women who were like, do you really expect me to vote for Joe Biden? And I'm like, but you were ready to vote for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, let's talk about the fact that he is a white man. Mm-hmm. You do not get any points for marching in Selma. You are still white.
Still white. Still
benefiting from the exact same privilege that Joe Biden benefits
exactly.
from.
Exactly.
Who would not even consider reparations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Knowing that he has been the beneficiary of reparations mm-hmm. for Holocaust survivors and their descendants.
Yep. Yep.
And you know, it's hard to have one issue that's going to be your hill to die on, you know, because Obama was also not in favor of reparations, and I voted for him twice. Mm-hmm. So you know, I'm not saying that I would never vote for someone who was not in favor of reparations. But what bothered me so much about Bernie and the fact that Black people continued to slobber all over him was to him it was a non-starter. And it was a nonsensical question to him.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't something he would even consider. Nope. Because there's one thing to say, 100% we need to find a way to make reparations happen, but we don't have the political will for it. Yeah. That's not what he said.
Exactly, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it really bothers me. But even if he had been in support of Bernie Sanders, even if he was like a Warren, who to me, you know, there was very little in her entire platform that I disagreed with. Mm-hmm. You know, she obviously has the issue of claiming the Indian, and she's not, and I'm not saying that's not a big issue, but in terms of her platform, I was in agreement with most of it. But even if it was something like, you know, a candidate like that who had come close to having the nomination and then didn't get it, my first reaction would not be, well, I'm just not going to vote,
right,
or
exactly.
I'm going to vote for the Republican. And I think Black women are able to do this, and this is mm-hmm. where the conversation with my best friend comes into place, because we never get our way.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? There are some people, and this is like hard for me to even understand, because I had never thought about it like this until my friend said it, but like, some people get their way. Some people get the candidate they want elected, either on a local level or on a national level. Some people get the legislation that's going to directly help them pass. The government works for a lot of people, but it does not, and it has never worked for Black women. And so I think we're just used to having to compromise. Yeah. We're used to having to say, well, who do we want to have the new codes, who we think won't accidentally press them?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, even if this is not the person who's going to bring about world change
yeah.
or, you know, rectify race relations, at least they won't blow up the world.
Well, and I feel like, I mean, mm-hmm. that just speaks to what I always describe as this kind of mental acrobatics that
yeah.
Black people, especially Black women, have to do. We constantly live in a both and world.
Yes.
And that we know that this candidate is not going to be for us as we would like, and we're still going to vote for them because it's the logical thing to do, right? They right. won't blow up the world, like you said. And just in listening to you say that, you know, it's infuriating that there is the expectation that we settle and compromise. Mm-hmm. And I think that not only does, healing from intergenerational trauma look like Black women being more unapologetic when it comes to not settling and not compromising. Mm-hmm. But obviously, of course, it also looks like the world giving us what we are rightfully due.
Right.
And coming back to Bernie Sanders, you know, it's really interesting because he did, it's funny because he was totally, I agree, like not, this is a nonsensical issue. Like what do you mean reparations? Like that was totally him. And then he started to change his tone as we mm-hmm. moved more deeply into the Democratic primary elections earlier this year. And even his approach to that, you could tell that it was still nonsensical. It was a non-debate thing for him, because he talked about how he was working with some other senator, some other white man to, you know, discuss how to go. And I'm like, really? That's how you're addressing reparations, by right. consulting some other white person in office? Okay, yeah, we see how serious you are about it.
Right.
So you're absolutely right.
He's like screaming at us about, but this is, you know, something he's, you know.
Right, exactly.
My friend can't have his impression.
Yeah. And then, of course, so now I'm thinking about Kamala Harris and, you know, her being the VP nom for Joe Biden. And I mean, I also have so many mixed feelings about this, too, you know. Yeah. And really, these are mixed feelings that started when folks were saying, oh, Stacey Biden should choose Stacey Abrams, blah, blah, blah. No, Stacey Abrams should be the presidential elect nominee, right? Like, Stacey Abrams doesn't need to play second fiddle to anybody. Neither does Kamala Harris. And so I feel very conflicted in this here too, because, you know, and I would love to hear your opinion on this, because I feel like she is in a very precarious situation where mm-hmm. she has to, you know, support the old white man. Mm-hmm. And in many ways that, you know, are kind of reminiscent of, you know, the black enslaved woman supporting her master, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's infuriating. And granted, people will argue that, well, she's a politician. She's hoping to get, this is all a part of a plan to become president someday. Mm-hmm. And black women, we're really good at long-term strategizing. Like, that's what we do, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm also like, to what expense? And I think one example I can think of why this feels so funky for me is, you know, I think you remember when Biden was being interviewed by Charlemagne and he said something to the extent of, if you don't know, if you're going to vote for Donald Trump, then you're not black. Like, he said that in an interview with Charlemagne the God. Yes. And he got a lot of flack for it and, you know, apologized for it. But I mean, again, not surprised, because we're still dealing with a white man, right? Right. And him, this is like a few months later, where Biden and Kamala Harris were interviewed and asked about this. And someone asked Kamala, like, you know, what's your response to what Biden said, or what's your response? You two got into this heated argument about busing during the civil rights era and, you know, moves that he made that really, you know, impacted you in negative ways. Like, what do you say about all that? And all she could do was respond that Joe Biden is this, he's a good man, he's a person of good character, and, you know, I support him and trust and blah, blah, blah. So for me, I mean, that's a political response, right? And, she, mm-hmm. you know, she kind of has to toe that line, being his VP pick. But even there, I still would have preferred if she said something to the extent of, you know, we've talked about it, and, you know, Joe continues to be engaged in what it means for racial justice to be had for Black Americans. And I hope to continue to support him, or something along those lines, you know?
That was more action oriented.
Right, exactly. Or at least a bit more authentic. So so many people, especially Black women, myself included, we're excited that Kamala is here and in the race. And personally, I feel like Joe needs her anyway. Because everybody needs Black women, because we're just, you know, just so magical. But I'm also kind of like, I still don't like how this feels.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you about Stacey Abrams. I was really happy that conversation didn't go that far, because I think she's a genius and she is just... I can't think of any other words, but like genius.
Yeah.
And she needs her own platform.
Yeah.
Whether it's president or something else, I think even just the strategy that she had is like, wow, how come nobody thought about that before? Like, exactly. You know, like, exactly. You spend so much time and energy registering people to vote and not talking about how hard it is to vote. My sister and I live in different states, and we've always lived in different states. And I always have lived in blue states and she's always lived in red states. And we are always constantly comparing, like, how much easier it is for me to vote than her. Yeah. Like, it's, and we're both, you know, college educated, you know, upper income Black women. Mm-hmm. So it's like all the barriers, like getting time off to vote, having reliable transportation, being able to read the ballot, being able to, you know, stay up with the news, all of that is not a factor.
Right.
But it's still, you know, the nuts and bolts of like how to vote is too hard for too many people. But anyways, I can never say her name. Kamala?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kamala. I always want to say Kamala. I don't know why.
Some folks say Kamala. I think she has corrected as Kamala.
Kamala, okay. You know, again, I don't know how this will be received, but I don't feel that much kinship with her.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the term that old Black people say, not all your skin folk are your kin folk.
Your kin folk, exactly. Yep.
I feel like she's skin folk and not kin folk. Mm. And I felt that way about Obama too. And I think it's less to do with the fact that they're mixed, and more to do with how much I know my experience as a Black woman is impacted by the fact that I can't pass for anything else.
Yeah.
That I have dark skin, that I have African features, that I have nappy hair, that all these things that just make my experience different from what her experience is. And I'm not saying it's her fault. I'm not saying that her life has been easier than mine, just different.
Right.
And so she's not someone who I can put myself onto as, you know, oh, you know, she really gets me. She really gets my experience. Mm-hmm. I also think, and this is again, like, you know, it's like a no-win situation, but she very much to me feels like talented 10th respectability politics, kind of pull up your pants and you won't get stopped by the police kind of Black person. Mm-hmm. Which I understand that style of Blackness. It makes perfect sense, you know, what they espouse is like would make sense if the world wasn't racist. Mm-hmm. But because the world is racist, it makes no sense to try to become the cleanest, most well-dressed, most well-spoken, most respectable Black person to curry favor with white people. It only gets you so far. And I think her presidential run is a case study in the fact that it won't ever take you all the way. So I think she is an asset to his campaign. I think the fact that she went to an HBCU, the fact that she is in a Panhale sorority, like, I think all of that definitely is, you know, getting her lots of cool points with lots of people, mainly Black women who would have voted for Biden anyway, but, you know, maybe they're a little bit more enthusiastic about their vote now. They feel more confident, which is good. But I personally don't feel super attached to her. If he had picked Tim Kaine, I think I would have felt this. I keep like digging Tim Kaine because he was just like, he just felt like the most random ass pick ever.
Oh yeah, I agree. I also was kind of like,
I was just like, and then I feel like they're announcing VP so late. It feels late now.
Yeah. Because
campaigns go on forever. So the summer before, it just feels like you've been campaigning for 2 years and now we see your VP, and I was just like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
She's fine. She's there. She's doing her job.
Well, I mean, I feel the same way. I also don't feel any kind of strong connection to her either. And I know that, you know, she doesn't have the best reputation out of California during her time there as AG. And I'm also not at all big on the fact that she is a strong supporter of the state of Israel and Netanyahu and that bunch over there.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. Well,
what are you telling me about that?
Yeah. I mean, I believe she attended the AIPAC convention a couple years ago and did so on the low. And I think she did it on the low because she knew that she was going to throw her bid in for president. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I also have my own, you know, feelings, mixed feelings around her. And at the same time, and this is me putting my bachelor's in poli sci hat on, she's a politician, you know. Mm-hmm. And so how she shows up and how she, you know, kind of makes her mark is going to be done in a traditional old party kind of way. Mm-hmm. And really, it's not like she can get away with doing anything other than that. So yeah. Well, I'm just, you know, I could just talk to you forever, actually. But I mean, this particular topic is so important. I'm curious to know, and this is what we'll close on. You know, how do you affirm and reaffirm and celebrate being a Black woman just on your own, even without the validation and celebration from others?
Yeah. So in typical, maybe this is a Libra thing, you tell me, but I like to have a preamble to like the answers to my question. Mm-hmm. And I also like to normally have like two or three parts. So I thought of a lot of things when you said that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've mentioned this to you either during this interview or earlier, but I have recently divested from white womanhood and Black manhood. Mm-hmm. And it has been very liberating. And I didn't realize how much I had invested in either of those institutions, but I think you can call them institutions. You know, I used to have white women who I consider friends. I used to do a lot of like feministy stuff, and I did learn from that, and I did feel affirmed as a woman in that. But when I found my identity as a Black feminist, and that's the term that I feel most comfortable with, mm-hmm. It allowed me to divest from white womanhood, which then allowed me to not seek validation from other people who are not Black women. And I think I've been on that path for a while now, and it feels great, because I don't put my trust in the DNC or any criminal justice system, or even any Black woman politician or celebrity or whatever. You know, I really see the path forward for me and for other Black women to liberation is within ourselves,
yeah,
and within our own communities.
Yeah.
And that was a big part of wanting to do Moonshine, because, you know, I was like, we have inherited this world that does not care about us, does not understand us, does not value us, and we can't change the world, and that's not even a good use of energy. But we can look at each other and say, I see you, yeah. I see what you're going through, I hear you, I understand you, I'm not going to gaslight you. And that was a big part of our conversation at Calabash, was just, we were talking to each other and we were like, yes, that's real.
Yeah.
Because it makes you feel like you're going crazy, or like you're not working hard enough, or you're not smart enough, or you're not pretty enough, or whatever. And none of that is true. And so for me, what I have been blessed with is a community of Black women who love me, who see me, who listen to me, who take me seriously. And from my mom to my sister to my friends. Are you good? Okay. I think that's the best answer to your question for me is being very intentional about who I surround myself with, and being very intentional about being vulnerable with other Black women, because I think there is also this, like, you know, strong Black woman facade that you that we sometimes have even with each other.
Yeah.
but I have
expected to maintain that facade.
Yeah. Exactly. And then we even, you know, and we don't do it out of malice, but we've been trained to, you know, when we see or hear another Black woman complain or be sad about something or talk about loss, it's not that bad. Right. God got it.
Yes.
Look at all the good in your life.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, those answers are not at all helpful.
In any way.
In any way whatsoever.
In any way. Like, you know, I'm trying to retrain myself from doing that. And I'm trying to gently, you know, talk to the women, the Black women in my life. Like, I know you only want to support me, but this is how you can support me. So anyways, I say all that to say that, like, being surrounded by Black women, being in community with Black women, being loved by Black women is a daily blessing. It's a daily affirmation. And I feel great. You know, I know, like, somebody could listen to me in this podcast and be like, well, she's just angry about everything. And it's like, you know, I can see problems with things, but that's not affecting my day-to-day. My day-to-day is beautiful.
Well, and even if you were angry, you're channeling that anger into what helps you to prioritize your peace.
And yeah.
That ultimately looks like surrounding yourself and allowing yourself to be fully loved up on by Black women and being in strictly Black woman community.
Yeah.
So I feel like, no, you did not share that with me. And this means we have to have a part two because I even like how you phrased it. You are divesting from white womanhood. Is that what you said?
Yes.
And Black manhood?
Yes.
Okay. So I feel like we need to talk more about that outside of podcasts, because I want to just talk to people about that personally, but then maybe coming back to podcasts, because I feel like for me personally, I go back and forth with that. I go back and forth between wanting to strictly and solely surround myself by melanin.
Mm-hmm.
And also recognizing, or also feeling, I don't know if guilt is the right word, but also feeling like, I think I often feel like I can't live that way when I could, if I made the choice to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I admire you for saying that and sharing that and for committing to it, because I agree. I don't think that when it comes to true liberation for Black people, I don't think that we can actually rely on white people to help.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, the reverence that Black women deserve, I don't think that we can rely on anyone except Black women to revere us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the world that I want to live in, you know? So thank you for sharing that. That's really powerful. And yeah, we're going to have to come back and talk more about that. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
And it makes sense too, that you are doing well, seriously.
Yeah.
Just from a psychological standpoint, emotional, mental, like when you just think of how whiteness eats away at every aspect of our being in this world, of course you're doing well having divested.
So I think that's
really powerful, and I'm so glad that we got to talk and that we got to hear your voice, and I'm so pumped to be able to share this with folks.
Thank you so much for asking me. This was such a great conversation. I feel like I always learn a lot when I talk to you, and I feel like you are so great at, and you are, you know, you are part of my tribe that makes me feel important and makes me feel loved and makes me feel listened to and validated. Not that, like, you know, we have to agree with everything the other person
says. Right, exactly. Just,
you know, I know that you regard me as a serious person, and that's really important to me, and I'm really thankful for it.
Thank you. See, the feeling is mutual, and I feel like I actually learn a lot from you. That's why I'm like, the person I need to have this conversation with is Whitney, for sure. So thank you for sharing and dropping your knowledge here, and you're going to come back, because we got okay. More stuff to talk about. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks again, Whitney. You take care.
You too.
All right.
Bye.
To Breonna Taylor and the Black women who have been shamelessly murdered by police, lives cut short, Corinne Gaines, Sandra Bland, Rekia Boyd, Tatiana Jefferson, Courtney Ashe Key. May all of you rest in power. And may your families find peace in power.